Good morning. The text this morning will be 1 Kings 18, and I'll give you the verses later. Some of you could turn to that. And the other text is 1 Kings 21. So just to pick up from yesterday, I mentioned that the process of biblical interpretation often involves one of two beginning points. In one beginning point, you try to shed as many modern presuppositions as you can and fully immerse yourself in the world in which the text was first written and the intentionality of the author. And that won't be the move we're making this morning. And in the second, you take full cognizance of the world that you actually do live in. What are the big issues of the day? What's the context in which you as a reader are situated when you come to this text? And that's the method that we will be taking. And the context I've suggested, even though Jeremiah Wright, President Obama's Chicago pastor in a UCC church, is now already receding in the American memory, you will surely recall that during the electioneering season, he, via his famous YouTube appearances, was a very big fixture in American life, and Obama's opponents, maybe even some of his friends, and including Hillary Clinton for a while when they were still both running against each other, made the most of Jeremiah Wright as an obnoxious and unacceptable American figure, and the proof that Obama himself was unfit to be president. Probably most American pundits, certainly cable TV, had little sense of the black church, and so wouldn't have known whether Jeremiah Wright was anomalous or typical. But what they did know is that he seemed to go out of his way to denounce America, even possibly cursing his country. And this just astonished Americans, even maybe liberal and progressive Americans, and certainly conservative Americans, who could not conceive that a religious figure, and above all, a Christian figure, since America is God's own country, would be denouncing the very country of which God was an honorary member. What struck me at the time is that the most obvious Christian voices, which is to say American evangelicals, had maybe the most difficult time imagining that a person with Jeremiah Wright's message could ever have such a message in the name of God. So that's the modern context from which we are going to launch ourselves back into 9th century BC, the world of what is sometimes called a non-writing prophet. There's no Elijah book in the Old Testament. His stories just appear in 1 Kings, and then his successor. And then he doesn't show up in the New Testament at all until the Mount of Transfiguration, when the first guy we looked at yesterday, Moses, and now today Elijah, appear together with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, which will entitle us on Friday to say, to ask whether maybe Jesus himself wanted to be understood, at least in part, as a prophet, since these two appearances to Jesus' disciples are the two, surely the two greatest prophets of the Old Testament tradition. So, Monday, yesterday, it was Moses, and today it's Elijah. And as yesterday, we'll start with having a couple people just read. In this case, I picked two of the most famous stories from Elijah's life. Other stories that you may remember from Sunday school or sermons is when the ravens feed him, and when there's a famine in the land, and a widow feeds him, and her supply of oil just keeps getting refilled by God as her reward for taking in a profit when she herself only had enough food in the kitchen for one last meal before she died. And there's a raising of the dead and so forth. But the two stories we're going to look at are maybe the most famous confrontation, one of the most famous confrontations in the Old Testament, and that is when Elijah deliberately foments a standoff between the followers of Yahweh, the God of Israel, and the followers of Baal, B-A-A-L, Baal, a Canaanite fertility deity. And, okay, so would someone read 1 Kings 18, 17 to 40?
I will.
Okay.
When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" He answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have forsaken the commandments of the Lord and followed their Baals. Now therefore have all Israel assemble for me at Mount Carmel, with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah, who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent to all the Israelites and assembled the prophets at Mount Carmel. Elijah then came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go living with two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." The people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, "I, even I only, am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets number 450. Let two bulls be given to us. Let them choose one bull for themselves, cut it in pieces, and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. I will prepare the other bull, and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. Then you can call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire is indeed God." All the people answered, "Well spoken." Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first, for you are many. Then call on the name of your God, but put no fire to it." So they took the bull that was given them, prepared it, and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, crying, "O Baal, answer us." But there was no voice and no answer. They limped about the altar that they had made. At noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud. Surely he is a god. Either he is meditating, or he was wandering away, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened." Then they cried aloud, and as was their custom, they cut themselves with swords and lances until the blood gushed out over them. As midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation, but there was no voice, no answer, and no response.
Okay. So let's just talk about that for a moment. So this is the great confrontation on Mount Carmel between the gods of the land. Remember, Israel had invaded Canaan, or Palestine, or whatever you want to call it, the land west of the Jordan River. And so this was these were the gods, the religious system of the native inhabitants. And then Israel brought with them, as we might say, its own God who had delivered them from Egypt and previously had been the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So now here's, and Yahweh, who repeatedly identifies himself in the Old Testament as a jealous God and one who will not tolerate idolatry, that is to say, idolatry and adultery are used, in English they even sound alike, but not in Hebrew, but they're sort of blended into each other, and so one definition of idolatry is whoring after false gods, which sounds a little like adultery. So God does not want what today we would call syncretism, that is, people making some kind of blend of multiple religious traditions so that everybody feels happy, okay? And that was really Ahab and his wife Jezebel, who came from the Canaanite culture. That was their commitment. I suppose we could call them inclusive politicians who thought that why not avoid offending anyone and embrace all the possible religions so that you can meld, you know, have a melting pot in the kingdom. This is northern Israel, a melting pot, and everybody just lives fine. So what strikes you in this text? It's so unlike what anybody would do today, it seems to me.
He's setting them up for failure.
Oh, the pagan gods. Yeah, okay. All right. So he proposes a contest, which he seems quite certain he will. But that's, of course, prophetic certainty. I don't know if any of us would be that certain. Like, let's say we say, okay, let's meet in D.C. or Baghdad and set it up between Allah and the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the father of Jesus, and let's have it out. Maybe most of us wouldn't absolutely be confident that we'd win. You know, I mean, as Luther would have said, who knows whether our God's going to be hiding that day, Deus absconding to us, and maybe just show us up as fools. So, but Elijah seems not in doubt that the God of Israel will come through, which he does in this First Kings story. But it's quite a bit of bravery or foolhardiness that Elijah engages in. Anything else?
A mockery.
Yeah.
Intriguing.
Yeah. A little after 9/11, Billy Graham's son, who inherited his father's ministry, made some politically incorrect remarks about Islam as a deficient religion, and took a fair amount of flack for it, he would have said, among the politically correct crowd. But it just wasn't kosher. George W. Bush always went out of his way to say Islam is a religion of peace, and Islam is not, does not stand for 9/11. And many and after one slip of the tongue, he told his handlers that he wouldn't use the word crusade anymore. And so most American officials, even conservative ones, went out of their way to be nice to Islam. And in our university life, where we often take students on trips around the world, so Carol and I have traveled in India with students, I mean, before we get off the ship, we school them in the cultural proclivities of Hindu India or parts of Muslim India, and dress properly and be respectful and take your shoes off in a Hindu temple, or someone will take them off for you. And we go to great lengths to develop respectful attitudes among our students. And now this mocking, like, maybe your God's asleep. Like, you know, sleep at the switch. Why doesn't he come out?
I'm just thinking, the closest thing I can think of between the confrontation between Yahweh and Baal would be sort of the confrontation between American capitalism and communism in those days.
Ah, yeah, and then, yeah, good point. Very good point. Because we did think of Nixon and Khrushchev's kitchen table debate, in which he said, you know, our economic system is better than yours, and our supermarkets are way more packed than yours are. So that's a great example, which I've never thought of. So there was two rival economic worldviews. We were quite comfortable. Each side made fun of the other. But since the 19th century, sometimes to make my wife really mad when we're traveling in India, I suddenly sing out the old missionary hymn, "The heathen in their blindness bow down to wood and stone." She immediately shushes me, lest anybody in India hear me singing such a hymn. But lustily, from Greenland's icy mountain, you know, lustily as children growing up in the Midwest, we sang that hymn every mission Sunday. But I'm not sure that hymn is even in... wasn't even in LBW, much less the current Crimson Book. So we mostly have chosen not to treat other world religions in a mocking way. Even if we treat other nationalisms or other economic systems, even today, that way. And of course, liberals and conservatives treat each other that way. Since the second election of President Bush, it was much remarked across the country that people you used to invite for Christmas, you now find intolerable to be in your house because they were on the opposite side of the political divide, and there was simply no way you were going to put up with people like that anymore. We were somehow driven to two polarities that hadn't quite been so conspicuous before. But when it comes to religion, we're mostly... Is it because we all think there's really just one God? Do you think that's what it is?
We preach tolerance a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the founding fathers wouldn't allow a state religion.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, Jefferson really thought, you know, all this stuff is just exactly what's distasteful about religion, which is why he carved up his own New Testament and took the miracles out. Jesus as a moral hero was admirable to Jefferson, but all the other stuff was unacceptable. I mean, he was an Enlightenment thinker. Now, the thing that I actually want to talk about after we've heard the other Elijah story is not so much affronting other gods, but Elijah's forced choice. When people, psychologists or Gallup people, construct polls, they often try to construct them in a way that involves a forced choice. You know, you don't give people so that they can easily pick out number three, neutral. You know, not too much of this, not too much of that. You try to do a forced choice, at least maybe A, B, C, D, B or C, but, you know, there's no convenient B and a half. I'm going to ask, if there is a forced choice, what's it a choice between these days? And is the church or our religious institutions... do they see themselves as doing that? Okay, but let's just get the other Elijah story on board. 1 Kings 21, 17 to 24. Would someone do that, please? Please.
Okay. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "Go down to meet King Ahab of Israel, who rules in Samaria. He is now in the vineyard of Naboth, where he has gone to take possession. You shall say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, have you killed and also taken possession?' You shall say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, dogs will also lick up your blood.' Ab said to Elijah, 'Have you found me, O my enemy?' He answered, 'I have found you, because you have sold yourself to do what is evil in the sight of the Lord. I will bring disaster on you. I will consume you. I will cut off from Ahab every male, bond or free in Israel, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, son of Ahijah, because you have provoked me to anger and have caused Israel to sin. Also concerning Jezebel, the Lord said, the dog shall eat Jezebel within the bounds of Jezreel. Anyone belonging to the Ahab who dies in the city, the dog shall eat, and anyone of his who dies in the open country, the birds of the air shall eat."
Okay. So this is the famous story of Naboth's vineyard. Naboth was a relatively poor person, but he had this vineyard land in the family for generations. And it happened to be proximate to the king's holdings. And there's a prophetic passage somewhere, Amos or somewhere, "Woe to those who lay house to house, field to field." Okay, real estate developers who try to accumulate as much land as possible, contiguous. So, goaded on by his wife Jezebel, Ahab offers a handsome price for the vineyard to Naboth, And Naboth says, oh, it would be a great sin against the generations of my family who have owned this land. You could hear an Iowa farmer speaking here, maybe. It would be a great sin against my heritage to sell off the land, even at a profit. No, we're keeping it to hand on to our children and grandchildren. And so Jezebel said, you know, don't take that. You're the king. So just go take it. So Ahab manages to get Naboth killed and appropriates the vineyard. And then word of this, you know, it's like this traveling moral story, reaches Elijah's ears, and he goes straight to the court and confronts Ahab. Now, I just wanted to mention, before we actually get to the questions on the board, imagine this scene. If you're such a liberal that you can't even imagine it, then imagine it under the previous administration. So let's say that we finally get the presiding bishop of the ELCA, or since I know there's a number of Episcopalians here, we get the woman who is the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church in the United States. And we're all quite proud. It's on all of our email grapevines, and we discover that that person has achieved a private audience with the President of the United States, who's calling her or him in for some, I don't know, religious coaching or advice. And we're very proud, and we hope that they will conduct themselves well and, you know, be proper and not too obnoxious and preacherly. And imagine then that the word gets out that President Obama, or if it makes you feel better, President Bush, says to the person, let's say in the first reading, ah, the presiding bishop of the ELCA, are you the troubler of Israel? Are you the burr in the saddle of the United States? That's the first story. Or in the second story, what's the name of the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church?
Catherine Jeffers Short.
Okay, so Catherine, have you found me, oh my enemy? Whoa, I mean, the whole Episcopal Church in the United States, or the whole Lutheran Church in the United States is really quite embarrassed. You know, one of our people finally, you know, made a private appearance in the White House, you know, not just Jerry Falwell or somebody, but one of ours. And then these persons are such well-known rabble-rousers that the president says either, welcome to the house, troubler of Israel. Who let you inside the Beltway? Or, in the second case, have you found me, oh my enemy? Okay, how did the Secret Service let you get beyond the gate? This would be problematic for us, except if there's anybody in the room who is really militant, you know, or maybe the nice word is prophetic. Maybe we would immediately blog that our person was publicly insulted by the president, and it was the finest day for our denomination. Because the president got it, that our denomination is the enemy of the smug nationalism of this country. But there wouldn't be too many of us who would think that. And of course, Fox News would just crucify us the next day. And maybe MSNBC and Rachel Maddow and others would, you know, sort of cheer them on. But do we really want our presiding bishop, you know, in a contest between MSNBC and Fox? And, you know, the New York Times would give a nice objective reporting of the whole thing. You see, what we just don't mostly think that way. But and the only reason I'm making such a big thing about it is there it is in the Old Testament, unhidden. You might have thought, as all scholars believe, that these documents went through innumerable recensions and future editing as they're compiled, especially since Elijah is not a writing prophet. So somebody else presumably is collecting these Elijah stories and inserting them out of the oral tradition into the Book of Kings, the books of Kings. So you might have thought when it was convenient to do so, we sort of expurgated, cleaned up these stories because they made Israel seem like such a contentious group of people and Yahweh such an unfriendly, uncompromising God who wasn't content to be equal to the other gods but had to be above them and leave them in the dust. No, to this day, there these stories are. and sometimes read as part of lectionary series A, B, or C, and preached on. Though I frankly can't remember an Elijah sermon lately, but maybe Episcopalians preach on Elijah more than Lutherans do. But you really want to chew on that. Have you found me, O my enemy? And are you the one who troubles Israel?
He's speaking out of guilt, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, or at least as in the John the Baptist, who's coming on Thursday, Herod has an uneasiness, part guilt, part awe, like, whoa, anybody that's got this much chutzpah might be authentic, you know? This could be a true word of the Lord, that you would have this kind of gall and audacity to appear inside the beltway so unfriendly and raw. So let those words ring in your ears now and then, in case one of our religious leaders makes it to be on Obama's prayer chain, or as a regular consultant to the White House. But aren't we really worried that our bishops would make nice? You know, like, I'm just so glad to be invited, you know. I'm sure I don't really have that much to say about healthcare, but okay, here's a couple of things. I really mean them well, and I certainly don't want to appear hostile, and the members of the ELCA or the Episcopal Church, you know, are really very supportive, and we're patriotic Americans and all that. We wouldn't really imagine the person being obnoxious and making a scene. The prophets seem to specialize in being obnoxious. This was their calling, and making scenes. And I can't remember whether I told this story yesterday. I mentioned a couple of you, but before I came, I was talking to a retired bishop who is in the same parish that we are in Gig Harbor, who, I won't tell you what synod he was from, who said that when churches sometimes got themselves in trouble with unusually fiery clergy, he would often be called in, and the pastor would defend himself by saying, it's usually a himself, you know, testosterone poisoning and all that. The pastor would defend himself by saying, well, I have a prophetic ministry. And the bishop said to me, it could have been true, but what I often found was just, this was an angry man. And isn't that an interesting question? Do you have to be slight personality disorder to make it as a prophet? If you're a smooth person who, you know, you've taken the Carnegie course and leadership courses and you're a graduate of the Wharton School and all that, you're probably, the president of Microsoft, you know, Steve Ballmer, he seems pretty comfortable being cantankerous. The more the better, I guess, seems to be working okay for Microsoft. We just don't quite, maybe you have to be slightly, I sometimes wonder, having, as I said yesterday, served on, a candidacy committee for PLTS, for people graduating from PLTS, the Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley. You wonder whether we filter all these people out before they have a chance of entering the parish. Like, you know, I noticed in your clinical pastoral education, which is to say your supervised hospital internship, that you seem to have some rough edges personality, you know, and maybe a lot of anger in you, or as someone once said to a friend of mine, you got a lot of crying to do. I think maybe you're not ready for the parish ministry. You are too uneven, too rough edge. So it could be we're filtering all the prophets out before they get a chance to be inflicted upon parishes. Wouldn't that be... Albert Schweitzer said in 1906 in The Quest for the Historical Jesus, the book that inaugurated the whole historical Jesus research, his Jesus was an apocalyptic, fire-breathing figure. And Schweitzer said, this is what, I mean, he's writing as a German, but he said, this is what the modern churches look like to me. You've got these explosive devices, you know, the kind that blow up trucks going by. You've got these explosive shells that come to us straight from the New Testament, and the pastor's job is to carefully remove all the powder and then pass them around for the admiration of his parishioners because they've been made safe. You know, they wouldn't blow up anybody. Not enough to blow your brains out, as they say. I mean, it was kind of a mean thing of Schweitzer to say, but it's stuck with me since I first read it. That if that's what the church is about, really, removing the powder so it doesn't blow up, so the gospel doesn't blow up in anybody's face, because it's just way too much to handle. That's also Dostoevsky, you know, in the Grand Inquisitor. The Grand Inquisitor standing in for the Catholic Church says, you know, why don't you just let us, you know, take the heat? We'll give you miracle, mystery, and authority, but not the powerful prophetic figure of Jesus. And believe me, you're going to much prefer miracle, mystery, and authority carefully filtered through the Catholic hierarchy than the explosive power of the New Testament. So that's Dostoevsky. I mean, surely he could have been speaking of the Orthodox, of Russian Orthodoxy as well. Well, to the first question. So here's the scene on Mount Carmel. There's two worldviews. And these aren't just, in today's sense, they're not just two slightly different views of God. You know, like we say, well, Allah, God, you know, it's just God. Allah is just Arabic word for it. But it's really one and the same. No, that's not Elijah's portrayal. There are two value systems, two worldviews, two ways of making your life work. And they have nothing to do with each other. And you are tempted to go this way, and I'm calling you out and trying to get you to go that way. Now, the question is, do you see any evidence today in modern Christianity that the church is called to push such a forced choice onto people? That's sort of part A. And part B is, if so, what today, obviously it's not Baal, what today is the forced choice? What are the two rival systems, worldviews, value systems, whatever? What do you think?
Well, there have been a number of famous atheist books that come out, so atheism versus theism would be one.
Yeah, okay. And in the modern period, that is to say, in the last decade where we've had our celebrity atheists, okay, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and so forth, the British scientist, Richard Dawkins, they're really playing the Elijah role. You know, they're putting up billboards that says, you know, surely reason is much more powerful than religious mystification. So the celebrity atheists in Europe and the United States are saying there's a choice, and it's time for thinking, college-educated people to make the choice for atheism and against religion, which they're only clinging to for sentimental reasons from their past.
And I see it within the Christian church is phenomenal. The tensions between going to the South, and racism is still alive and well. They've never heard about who's your neighbor. Or if you go into certain congregations, you know, the views are so different from each other that the confrontation potential is very high. And you see that confrontation come out in all kinds of, within the media, within the church, just within the Christian church itself, let alone between the Christian church and the non-Christian section. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's phenomenal.
So you're saying certainly that today there is no shortage of polarizations.
Yes.
It's clearly there.
In the Episcopal Church, there are splits primarily on a local level between people who do not want to permit gay people to have a full role in the church. So the people that believe in the inerrancy of the Bible are leaving. They want to take ownership of the property for them, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it splits up parishes.
By the way, let me just pause. I'm sure we're not outing anybody here because we're all proud of our traditions. But besides Lutherans and Episcopalians, of whom I'm aware, what other religious traditions are represented here this morning? Presbyterian? Okay. Okay, UCC. Okay. So, just to take that one issue, but I don't want to skew the course that way. Just to take that one issue, Presbyterians early this year decided against, not that this is the only litmus test of the modern age, but the Presbyterians this year narrowly defeated a resolution which would have allowed gay clergy, and the Methodists narrowly defeated one last year. So, and in the vast evangelical tradition, and of course in the Catholic tradition, such a question would never even come to the table. Even women's ordination is not allowed as a question to emerge in the National Council of Catholic Bishops by order of the Vatican. So those of us who are Lutherans and Episcopalians, unless we're Missouri Synod Lutherans, actually my own original tradition, but if we're in the ELCA or the Episcopal Church in the United States, we, together with the UCC, United Church of Christ, we are the only three traditions that have worked our way through, more or less, the issue of gay clergy and come out on the inclusive side, at least the inclusive side as an option, while allowing individual parishes to say it's not a move we would want to make in the present context. So this is really a highly skewed, we are a highly skewed sample, okay? Most of us in this room belong to religious bodies that in the eyes of many other Christian bodies are completely apostate. That is to say, we are completely apostate. We are departures from the historic Christian tradition from the West, or from modern African Christianity.
I mean, isn't each faction a result of a choice? Do you allow divorce or not? Do you allow this or not?
Yeah.
And so whenever there's a cleavage there, that's how you create a new organization.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Almost like a karmic strand. So every choice leads to additional choices. And, you know, our individual lives as well as our institutional lives are created out of a whole series of choices, often forced choices. I can surely say for Lutherans, and it must be the same for Episcopalians and UCC, nobody woke up in the bureaucratic headquarters of these religious bodies and decided, well, let's do the gay issue in the next decade. No, it was forced on us. The society, the culture, forced that issue, just as abortion and all kinds of other things got forced. Besides the ones that you're already mentioning, are there other powerful opposites with which the church is confronted?
Well, is there just like the general, you know, materialism and the pursuit mm-hmm. of your personal happiness versus, you know, a different mm-hmm. service and, mm-hmm. you know, being able to do that sort of thing?
Yeah.
I was just wondering, isn't the church a little inhibited from pulling the Elijah moment? Wasn't it something Jesus said about thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God? Does that come down to do the Elijah story again? Or is that irrelevant?
Yeah, so let's imagine a mega church. So I don't want to keep picking on St. As you know, the only reason I mention St. Mark's is that Carol and I deeply admire it and get there several times a year. But we don't want to just pick on great urban cathedrals, but let's just say a highly successful, visible church. So here would be an example of an Elijah temptation. The pastor says, I'm going to be prophetic. The church happens to be packed with CEOs, insurance industry people, and such. And they say, you keep going this way, we're leaving, and we're, of course, pulling our contributions. And now you see how the Elijah thing would work. Elijah said, okay, the pastor in the Elijah model says, okay, go. go with all your money. I have no idea how we'll even pay the janitor anymore, and I know my salary's down the tubes. But just go, because the God of the Father of Jesus Christ, the church is one foundation, the Father of Jesus Christ and the theology of the cross, we all know our St. Paul, will simply keep this church from going under and take your money with you as you go out the back door, the front door. Well, we would think that person needed some management consulting, wouldn't we? You know, there'd be people called, as St. Mark's has actually gone through, but in any of these churches, there'd be experts called in, psychologists, and, you know, interviews, and when did your pastor first seem to get angry? Was something going on in home life? Is he an alcoholic? Why? And the same thing happens in, we should also mention that that this Northwestern Washington was also the seat of Bishop Hunthausen, of blessed Catholic memory, who once called Seattle the Auschwitz of Puget Sound, endearing him to the Boeing people. And as I teach in my ethics classes, if you want to know whether money is powerful, watch what happened to Bishop Hunthausen. When wealthy Catholics went to the Vatican and said, this, they didn't say prophet, I'm sure, this prophet must go. And he did. Unceremoniously ushered out of the diocese. So that would suggest that in modern confrontations, the non-Elijah wins. And the Elijah loses. But there must be a role. When we were, we have a group of retired clergy, but you know, we're still alive and everything. Retired clergy in Gig Harbor, we meet once a month now. Talk about death and things, illness, just kidding. So the same bishop said that he thought that are we gonna have a prophet or a kind of chaplain, that's a forced choice that you don't have to make. And that pastor, the word pastor, the role of pastor is a historic role, and especially as a Lutheran would understand it, the pastor comforts and challenges, speaks law, speaks gospel, afflict the comfortable, comfort the afflicted, you know, that kind of bifurcation. And the pastor has a prophetic ministry and a priestly or chaplain ministry in her own role. Her own single role, her own self-consciousness. So that a good pastor who understands law and gospel, who understands comforting and challenging, is playing that role, but not exclusively. Not just the prophetic role. It could be if you just played the prophetic role, you'd be in jail all the time. You know, climbing the fence at Bangor. So the church would be paying you a salary for being sort of full-time in jail, which maybe would be an interesting notion. The ELCA has done that now and then in the Northwest.
Like the Berrigan brothers, right?
Yeah, in the Catholic tradition, the Berrigan brothers.
Well, will it come to pass, do you think, 10, 20, 30 years from now, that Pastor Jeremiah Wright will be, they will find good things about what he's doing. I mean, I can't imagine, even though I don't know, I don't have lots of background studying the history of the Black Church, but I can imagine that not only were his comments taken out of context, but the correspondence covering that really couldn't understand, you know, what the guy was really trying to say. Of course, they didn't have time with it.
I mean, 10 years ago, before everybody had a religious staff writer, the major dailies, we used to say in the university that the New York Times wouldn't know what an evangelical was if it bit him. And it could be that most, not to mention cable news, but even the great American dailies wouldn't have really no clue about the Black Church. And this was just more of same. Maybe Jeremiah Wright comes mantle to the black church, but since we know nothing about the black church, it's easy to dismiss him, and maybe in African-American studies courses in the next decade, we'll rehabilitate him. I mean, really, Carolyn could surely say that if you caught me on YouTube in one moment of my life, you could surely make a complete fool of me. So would any of us in our marriages or our professional careers or our parenting want to be hung on one YouTube extravagance? Although Jeremiah Wright would say it wasn't an extravagance, so I mean, he really doesn't want to be saved by liberal white people. No, I meant every word, I suppose he would tell us. I have to let this go so I can get to the next question, but I guess I would have thought that a modern Christian prophet standing on the mountain would have said, as someone suggests in the back of the room, there's global capitalism, or as someone corrected me yesterday, local capitalism, so the personal is political and all that. There's capitalism as an all-encompassing system of meaning and values with complete demands on us and defining us as not disciples but consumers. Okay, there's that, and there's then a Christian or Jewish or Buddhist or whatever value system. And really, you're going to have, I mean, Jesus himself says, is it God or mammon? Because the two will corrupt each other. So, but really, especially if you're on a salary, and the salary is partly paid for by highly successful capitalists in your congregation, but maybe that isn't the issue. You don't hear that many American preachers or official pronouncements saying the church in the modern world must choose between a capitalist value system and a religious value system. You just don't hear it that much. The Pope, by the way, the present and the previous, sometimes does make statements like that. And going back to the late 19th century, the great Catholic social encyclicals, which all of us in religious studies departments teach in modern universities. But what happens if you're a conservative American Catholic, you sort of say the Pope had a bad day. He didn't really mean it. Because the church's business is not to be attacking capitalism.
The choices that you're describing here are different than the ones that Elijah put forth. His seem to be, are you a member of our organization or not? Which would seem to be, okay, in the growth of an organization, he was the marketer, the entrepreneur to get it building, whereas they're all...
Yeah, staff, okay.
Whereas the church is, in its various forms, is established now, and the value choices you're describing are just, okay, which direction do we want? Uh-huh. It's not about the survival of the organization.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you could, if you were a modern marketer or a social scientist, I could imagine analyzing Elijah, in fact, this would be a great article, analyzing Elijah as a brand intensifier. You know, Israel is in danger, Yahweh is in danger of losing his brand, his brand identification. And so Elijah has to call it out. You know, finally it's going to be between a ridiculously squishy Wonder Bread and whole grain goodness. And the God of Israel stands for whole grain goodness. And it's time to part company here and settle the brand. Yeah, how delicious that would be. And when the social scientists look at us, and no doubt some of us are social scientists, it can often be quite illuminating. And it's quite common in sociology of religion of the last 25 years to see the American denominational system as market-driven. So each person is looking for a niche audience. You know, for years, you know, we said when you make enough money, you become an Episcopalian. And now even a Pentecostal can be rich, so you no longer have to transfer to the Episcopalian church. Although if your ascetic values are strong, then probably you're still going to have to go that way. Okay, so we have to move to the next one. So in the story of Naboth's vineyard, Elijah just feels profoundly moved by this Naboth story that's making the rounds. And, you know, he goes straight to the White House with it. And so, you know, if we wanted to magnify this and set it into a larger context, you know, it wouldn't be, did Bush or Obama or somebody confiscate adjacent real estate. No, it would have to be about America, right? Okay. Has America moved in on proximate countries and cultures and taken them over? And is that fair? And will God tolerate that? So you have to occasionally, when we teach social ethics, especially biblical ethics, you always have to do the Good Samaritan story, and then you have to globalize it. Because as long as it's just, is there this guy from outside the community who actually does the good thing? Okay, it's a tame story, because it doesn't become systemic. But as soon as it becomes a systemic issue, is there anybody who is founding hospitals or healthcare systems or feeding the poor or whatever on some national or global or even regional scale? Because otherwise, the Good Samaritan story is just a nice personal charity story that somebody gave, opened their wallet a little more than they usually do. So if we wanted to make Naboth's vineyard, it's not does somebody in power take the neighbor's land. It's you have to exponentialize it. Does the United States take people's stuff? Does it commandeer other cultures? Does it, under coaching by Jezebel, whoever that would be, does it, under Jezebel's influence, say, why don't you use your power? You have so much power just at your beck and call. Use it a little bit.
Did Madeleine Albright?
Yeah, Madeleine Albright famously said to Colin Powell, what do you got the army for if you're not going to use it? George Bush must have been listening to that prior to becoming president. But would that involve taking sides? In other words, if you have a default position, would the default position of Christianity be you always side with the poor? Catholic theology has this term that those of us close to that tradition all know, but I wonder whether people know what it means. It comes out of Catholic liberation theology, preferential option for the poor. But let's use the American term, affirmative action. Okay, that's what that term means. God is affirmative action on the side of the poor. And when there are goods to be passed out, the church wants to raise its voice to see that the passing out is skewed towards the poor. Okay, that's what preferential option for the poor means. That's what affirmative action means, to right previous and historic wrongs. But we're nervous about that in the United States. So Obama, I mean, if you're a real leftist, Obama is never left enough. And during the campaign and now, Obama's people and Obama himself would not be caught bashing the wealthy. They might be accused of that, you know, milking the rich. But they wouldn't mean to be saying that. But Elijah seems to mean to be saying that. And Amos, as we'll see tomorrow, looks out at his congregation, sees fairly ample, wealthy women, calls them fat cows. Okay, fat cows of Bashan, Amos says. You know, not a typical endearing homiletical method. Does it seem like, do you feel that your parishes, I mean, in our parish, you know, we paint houses and we do Habitat for Humanity and Tacoma Food Bank and Gig Harbor Fish Fund or whatever it's called. Does it seem like modern Christianity, and some evangelicals do too, Rick Warren's church and some of the mega churches go out of their way to do stuff in Africa or Asia or does it seem like Christianity today conspicuously raises its voice for the poor?
No.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Just sometimes.
I see the church, I mean, for me, it's not so much as taking a stand against the wealthy and powerful, but rather giving each individual a chance to make real change. Or agitate, or not just to really advocate for not just panacea things to help, but to really
to change the way our system works. Mm-hmm. And it's, so it's not so necessarily rich against poor, but it's working together to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And of course, there are choices. When Kyle and I were first married, I was still a Berkeley liberal talking about the Colossus of the North, namely the United States. And Carolyn would always say, you know, that economic theory doesn't need to, it's not always zero sum. It doesn't need to be quite like that. That every time there's Alexander Dumas' famous line, behind every great fortune is a crime, you know. And behind every poverty, there's a rich capitalist. Not all economists think that you need to reduce it to that level of. And you're saying to raise your voice for the poor might not mean castigating all the rich. And there are surely many Christian economists, conservative Christian economists, or conservative economists who are Christian, or not, who would say that when some people do well, a rising tide lifts all boats and stuff like that. Was there another? Yes?
I was thinking about an example being Shane Claiborne, The Simple Way, you know, some folks here read the that whole piece about being living in solidarity with, and that's mm-hmm. whole, that's where I think it's happening. And I guess that's my question about how do we do more of that. Mm-hmm. And that's a very unique thing about them living in an inner city and having a very different life. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's necessarily my calling.
Yeah.
You know, but and James says that when he speaks, mm-hmm. listen to what your calling is. Mm-hmm. But it challenges me to try to listen to people and see the difference of doing kind of charity work versus
yeah.
being with.
Yeah, so there must be many callings, and one should, especially the righteousness of the left, should perhaps be cautious in assigning callings according to our own ideological proclivities.
I think, looking at it that way, I would think that if we see our church not being preferential right now, we're assuming that there is symmetry. And what I mean by that is that oftentimes we speak about poverty in our churches, but we do not speak of wealth. And until we speak of both, then maybe then we can say the church is now able to serve both groups. Mm-hmm. But I feel like that's not, it doesn't exist right now.
And you think we're failing to speak of wealth prophetically, that is to say, questioning it?
Yeah, I mean, in any which way, when we we'll talk about global poverty, but we will not talk about wealth. And so for me, in that conversation, it needs to be skewed until we have that symmetry, I think. And so.
Mm-hmm. And see, as American, it's often, pollsters often assert that the reason even poor Americans don't want to escalate the capital gains tax is that they assume that it's only a question of time before they become millionaires.
Yeah.
And so they don't want to be screwed when they finally make it. You know, is this going to happen? But Americans want to be quite fair-minded. So the final image I want to leave with you, probably many of us over the years have participated in Jewish-Christian seders, and I certainly have, and I don't really recall a place set for Elijah. But if you read about the traditions, the tradition is that when having the annual Jewish seder, you set a place, and so that's the image I want to leave you with. You set a place for Elijah. You set, and metaphorically then, you are setting a place for an absent voice, or in terms of the hierarchy of the church, an absent role, an absent prophetic vocation. And so if every meal, every Eucharist, every national church council meeting, every regional group, you say, has anyone set a place for Elijah? You see what a powerful metaphor it is. Because I would say most of us, when we enter a cafeteria, we don't ask the question, what's missing here? There's a lot of stuff here, and it's good. Like at Holden, it's a lot of good. So you don't, it seems some, you know, why concentrate on what's missing? But a critical person says, it's good, it's all good, but what's missing? I don't see a place for Elijah here. We're all so happy, so self-congratulatory. The abundant goodness of God, the table's overflowing. But where's Elijah? Where's Elijah? Thank you.